Fasten your seatbelts and turn up your radio. We're going on a road trip. With hundreds of varieties in Wisconsin and thousands worldwide, our lives are continuously touched by birds. Amazing creatures known for the superpower that we all wish we had, the ability to fly. The freedom and splendor of birds in the wild forever fascinates us, from their unique behavior patterns to their elegant colors and more. Though birds can be seen all year round in Wisconsin, the spring migration season is one of the best times to see a wide range of species and enjoy their beauty and song. Welcome to Route 51. I'm Shereen Seawort. While many consider the robin to be the official sign that spring in Wisconsin has arrived, there are many other birds that migrate here by mid-April. Today, the early migrants like ducks, cranes, and geese have already gone through, with songbirds soon to arrive. In the coming days and weeks, they'll be building their nests, flocking to area marshes, and delighting bird-watching enthusiasts throughout the state. Today, we explore the world of wild birds in Wisconsin with advice on how to identify them, feed them, and nurture their existence. Throughout the program, we invite you to join the conversation. You can ask your own questions by calling us at 800-780-9742 or email ideas@wpr.org. Steve Bechkel is a professional ornithologist, educator, and Emmy Award-winning journalist with more than 50 years of experience in birding. He is the Eau Claire liaison for Bird City Eau Claire, co-editor of Wisconsin's favorite bird haunts, and an expert on bird migration and the impact of climate change on the world bird population as well. Steve, welcome to Route 51.
Thanks, Shereen.
Jeanette Kelly is a wildlife biologist, ornithologist, and educator at Beaver Creek Reserve, where she spent the last 11 years as citizen science and education director. With more than 25 years of experience, Jeanette works with individuals, local universities, and conservation organizations to collaborate with international researchers on a project that will enable Wisconsin and the Chippewa Valley to participate in high-impact research and education of migratory species throughout North America. Jeanette, thank you so much for being a part of our program today. It's great to meet you.
Thank you for having me, Shereen. Happy Earth Day.
Yes, indeed. So, Steve, which species of bird are we seeing in Wisconsin right now? And I guess how far have they traveled to get here?
Well, you have to think of migration in terms of waves, Shereen. We've had the first wave go through. Those are the short distance migrants, the birds that were in Iowa or Missouri or just in southern Wisconsin. And those have all come in, robins, killdeers, phoebes, things like that. And then the ducks come through. And in mid-April, the hawks come through. And what we're seeing now in the third week of April are the short to medium range migrants, the ones that are coming from the Gulf. And then the first neotropicals, the first birds that are coming from across the Gulf of Mexico that have big wings. So this week, we're seeing things like brown thrashers come in, and the swallows are coming in, and broadwing hawks are migrating. They've come from all the way from Argentina. And so birds like that that have bigger wings that can travel faster are starting to show up from a long distance away. And then next month, we get all the neotropical migrants that have small wings, all the little birds, the vireos and tanagers and warblers and things like that.
I'm really curious about the migration process. It's just mythical to me to think that these birds are coming from as far away as Argentina, as you just mentioned. So how do they know, Jeanette, how do they know when to start migrating? How do they know where to go?
Yeah, so there's been this has been a topic that has been studied for many, many years and for eons and eons. And I believe it's a topic that we will continue to learn about for many, many years to come. But we have been learning a lot, and I'll just briefly touch on it. And Steve is great in talking about this subject, but there has been research through the years. First of all, just let me just touch on some beliefs throughout history. One time it was believed that birds didn't actually migrate as we know them to do today, but that they burrowed underground in the mud along ponds, similar to a frog or maybe what a turtle would do. So our knowledge of migration has changed tremendously through the years. And we now know that there's certain cues that lead them along their way, seasonal changes, food, so temperature, snow leaving, ice leaving, trees budding out, insects coming out. A lot of those food cues and seasonal cues are certainly encouraging them to move along their way. We also know that they use celestial patterns to help them migrate. There is some experience with birds where we as humans have actually taught them new migration routes when we've had, when we've needed migration routes adjusted. So there's lots of facets and parts to migration. And Steve, I'll let you expand on that too.
Yeah, yes. Bird migrations is the greatest natural event on the planet Earth. There's nothing that compares. You can talk about the power of hurricanes or volcanism or anything like that, but bird migration happens all over the planet. It happens on every continent, even Antarctica. It's happening all over us, on top of us, whether we know it or not. Millions of birds passing overhead. And like Jeanette said, we're still learning many things. We just discovered recently that some birds are able to detect magnetism in the cornea of their eyes. And so there's many ways and different ways that birds use to navigate. One thing that you asked is, how do birds know?
Yes.
Well, there's this great German word called Zugenruhe, which is migratory restlessness. And birds feel this. They get this sensation. And photoperiodism is one of the biggest triggers. A bird is excited by the amount of light that they see, the longer daylights, where the sun is coming up. And so this really triggers this Zugenruhe, and they get up this urge to go, and they know they've got to head north or they got to head south in the fall. And then they proceed using these other cues to find their way back to this site where they were born. Now, generally speaking, they come to site fidelity to the spots where they were born.
When do they start building nests? When the birds that are here, that migrate here, get here, do they start building nests right away? Do they start mating right away? What happens when they arrive? Jeanette, do you want to start?
Yeah, it really depends on the species Some of the birds are coming and setting up territories. Some birds have stayed around for the winter and may have stayed on territory. So in general, the process is they come back, they're finding their territories, they are attracting a mate, and then they start building their nest. And this process takes a different amount of time for various species. For instance, just going off something Steve had just said too about returning to their nesting area. For example, American kestrels, which are a small falcon that we have here in Wisconsin and throughout the country, they have started showing up over the past month. And those birds now, we have an American kestrel nest box monitoring program we do here at Beaver Creek. And so those birds we saw them showing up a month ago. In the last few weeks, we've seen them pairing up. So we've seen pairs together. And now this last week, we found a kestrel in a nest box. So now we know they're starting to formulate their nest and they're getting their nest ready. And one thing that was really interesting that I wanted to point out, taking off of what Steve said, is the bird that we just found in a nest box was a bird that we banded as a juvenile bird. So as a chick in its nest a few years ago, we banded it, and it has now returned not to the same nest box, but to that same general area. And now as an adult is building its own nest with its mate.
That is so interesting. And I'm going to be asking you about the banding program a little bit later on. Steve, we were just talking about, she was just saying that you're starting to see these birds that are pairing up. We hear about birds that mate for life. How does that work? And how do they stay together? And then what happens when a mate dies? It's so fascinating.
Yeah, you have to remember that this is a phenomenon that can only happen with birds that are staying together. And so neotropical migrants, birds that migrate from here to the tropics or here to Paraguay, a little bird like that can't mate for life because their life expectancy is maybe 2 or 3 years old because they have so many hazards that they face and they have such a great distance to travel. So big birds like cranes or geese or trumpeter swans, they might mate for life because they are very large. They can identify each other. They don't travel that far. They don't migrate that far. And I want to add, by the way, to Jeanette's points that, this breeding thing, it's been going on since the first of the year. Great horned owls have been mating and building nests and laying eggs in January. And so this is not a spring phenomenon. And the courting and the preparing for this is happening as the birds migrate. They are practicing their singing. They're looking for mates. They're sometimes bonding as they fly. And by the time they get back, a lot of birds have already prepared themselves for that process of nest building.
So if we want to go beyond the backyard to see birds in a natural habitat, what are some really good spots in central and western Wisconsin that you can go to make that happen and really observe the many species that we have here, Jeanette?
So for me, when I go birdwatching, and sometimes it depends on what exactly I'm looking for. So am I looking for a grassland bird? Am I looking for a bird that's more likely to be in the woodlands? Am I looking at waterfowl? So sometimes the habitat comes into play. But some areas, I mean, I have to put a foot in for Beaver Creek Reserve because we are an excellent place to come birding. Mm-hmm. And come out here. And we've got the river here and some savanna and woodlands. So some diversity of habitat. I know the Mississippi River, especially during migration season, is a fabulous place to go birding. There's a lot of, in the local Eau Claire area, there's a lot of really great haunts known by local birders. Over in the, oh boy, I just lost the name of it. There's a county park I know in Wausau when I lived over there that I used to attend quite a bit. Crex Meadows in the northern part of the state, I'm hoping to head up there really soon. There's also, you'd have to head up more to Duluth, but the hawk migration is spectacular up there. And Buena Vista is also an amazing place to go and see cranes and grassland birds and some of the raptors. There's some great information out there and that's put out by the DNR about birding haunts in throughout Wisconsin, and it even breaks it down into different regions. And I believe if you go onto their website, you can probably find those resources.
Speaking of resources, I'm a beginner when it comes to birding. My husband is really good at knowing, oh, that's a red-winged blackbird or whatever in our backyard. But for me, I'm just, oh, pretty bird. And I want to know more about what they are and more about the birds that are in our area. Do you have any resources that you can suggest for like a beginner like me who wants to know more about identifying birds? Are there any good apps or websites that you think might be helpful for somebody like me?
I have always recommended one of the best ways to learn birds is to find someone to go with that knows their birds. I can tell you that I knew a fair amount of birds when I moved to this area, but then I went birding with Steve one time and he taught me a lot, even, you know, on top of what I had already known. So going with someone else is, I think, one of the best ways to do it. And birders are very friendly and birders love to talk about birds and birders love to share their knowledge about birds. So often by looking into a local Audubon chapter or a wildlife chapter, you can find a birder to go out with. Lots of areas have birding groups. I think that's one of the best ways to learn birding is go where there's other birders. Steve, do you want to touch on apps and things like that?
Yeah, first I have to make a pitch for the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology, that the WSO, as is known, is the premier bird club in Wisconsin. You can join that and you have the chance to go on field trips all around the state with experienced birders and beginning birders. It's a great way, a comfortable way to immerse yourself in education and to learn. I mean, when we have every September, third week of September, we have Jägerfest on the lake in Lake Superior. And you look down the beach and there are 30 birding scopes pointed at the lake and people pointing at birds. You know, oh, there's a Sabin's gull. There's a Jäger coming over. Oh, here's a Harris's sparrow behind me. It's a great way just to soak it all up and to learn from people. Also, places like the Cornell Laboratory of Ornithology have all sorts of online applications and resources for you, as well as National Audubon, the American Birding Association. All these are online presences that really provide a lot of information. One thing I use, too, for bird songs is xenocanto.org. It's xeno-canto, and that's one of the best warehouses, as in addition to the Laboratory of Ornithology, for learning bird songs.
Thank you so much for those resources. It sounds great. You're listening to Jeanette Kelly and Steve Bechkel on Route 51. We're exploring the wild bird population as the spring migration season is underway in Wisconsin. Coming up, some facts about birds that might surprise you, tips for best feeding practices, and we'll answer your questions too. When you call us at 800-780-9742, you can also send an email to ideas@wpr.org. I'm Shereen Seward. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're back on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward. Steve Bechkel and Jeanette Kelly are with us today for a discussion on wild birds and their unique features. What would you like to know? Email us at ideas@wpr.org or join us by phone at 800-780-9742. Jeanette, you're a wildlife biologist. I read that birds originally descended from reptiles. Is that true or is that a myth?
Oh, that's a good question. Interesting question, too, because my coworker, Tolly Frayne, just did a presentation the last hour about feathers, scales to feathers, and about that idea of evolution. What I say in regards to that is there's a lot of ideas, there's a lot of theories out there, and people have different beliefs. So as a scientist and ecologist and I have different opinions that other people might have. So I would say that I believe on that line of thinking, but that's certainly not what everybody believes. So it just, that's a hard one, I think, to answer.
I asked a loaded question then.
Well, yes.
I want to ask this too. My husband always gets super excited when he sees a robin in the spring. He's one of those people that says, it's the sign of spring. So Steve, is the first robin of spring a thing or is it an avian myth?
No, there's it's people. I'm excited that people get excited about birds. I think that's great. But we tend to think in little boxes in terms of seasons. And here in our latitude, the seasons really aren't that equal. And birding, the bird migration is starting in late February. And so if you call a robin in your yard and you see that in mid-March, there are a lot of birds that already arrived. Red-winged blackbirds have showed up, horned larks and cranes and geese. And so the first sign of spring, if you're really observant, is happening in the end of February and not in March 21st or March 22nd, whenever we put spring on a calendar. And in terms of migration, then people see robins. Usually the first male robin will start to show up in the first week of March in most yards around our latitude. And people are excited. I think that's great.
Absolutely. Well, let's talk about feeding. What are some of the best ways to attract birds with backyard feeding practices? What do they like to eat? What's the best stuff to get?
Sure. I'll jump on this, Stephen, if you have anything to add afterwards. Mm-hmm. So backyard bird feeding is a fantastic thing to do. And I always just have to remind people that backyard bird feeding is just as much, potentially even more for us people than it is for the birds. People get concerned a lot. You know, I'm going away. What's going to happen to my birds while I'm on vacation? I have to get someone to come feed them. Birds survive just fine without our bird feeders. There are times of the year that maybe it provides them a boost and a little bit of a safety net, but it definitely is for our enjoyment. And you know what? That's fantastic. There's absolutely nothing wrong with that. It helps us build that connection to that wildlife. Mm-hmm. Some of the a fantastic resource for learning about birds is if you have a Wild Birds Unlimited in your area, they are a fantastic resource for everything about backyard bird feeding. But a few things that are really important to keep in mind, all living things in order to survive need food, water, and shelter. And if you can provide those three things in your backyard, that's going to help you to attract birds. Water, this time of year in the spring and in the summer, even in the winter, but that is a huge attractant, especially if you can have running water. And that might be a dripper that you can add to your bird bath or a sprayer. Somehow making that movement and that sound is a huge attractant for birds. So
I'm sorry. Go right ahead.
So water and then food and shelter. And with food, I say if you're going to feed one thing, feed black oil sunflower seed. It is the most common bird seed out there that all birds find very palatable.
I want to also ask you about the food needs of birds. Do they change as the year goes along, or do they pretty much stay the same all year long?
Go ahead, Steve. Go ahead.
No, that is a good question. They do change because we see that birds are, you can see this from their beaks. They're basically, they have preferences. They're insectivore. They're a carnivore. They're an omnivore. They're a frugivore. They're a granivore. Whatever they are, you can tell that, but when the birds, this is really interesting scientifically, even a hummingbird will supplement its diet of nectar with bugs to build up its protein, its fat, so it can migrate. And birds that are birds that like fruit, you see orioles feasting on jam in the spring, or birds that eat grain, will still feed their young birds insects because that's higher protein. And so they will jam insects down their baby's mouth instead of seeds or jam because they want those babies to grow up big and healthy and fat. And so in migration too, a bird might adapt to what it needs based on energy needs to build up fat content. And sometimes if they're stressed, they change their diet. A bird that can't find bugs might have to eat, stop in at a feeder and try to eat some suet, or it might try to eat worms that are put out, mealworms, or warblers that can't find insects might have to eat bayberries in migration. So stress may have something to do with how they adjust their diet.
Interesting. With all the seed
in there.
Yes, yes.
I had learned about black-capped chickadees this past year is that black-capped chickadees during that first week after their chicks hatch, they primarily, we think of black-capped chickadees at our bird feeders, eating black oil, sunflower seed, peanuts, suet. But during that first week of their chick's life, they primarily feed them spiders.
Really?
They collect hundreds and hundreds and thousands of spiders, and that is basically what they feed their chicks. And what they believe is that it is because spiders contain a lot of taurine. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. And they have found in studies that taurine seems to really help in brain development and function of young critters. So they believe that is why chickadees turn to spiders to feed their babies.
Wow, that's incredible. I did not know that. There are so many seed mixes and options out there. I mean, you could shop for and just not know what to get. Are there specific like combinations of food that we should be looking for that's really healthy for the birds, that really can promote the health of the birds?
Can I tell you what to stay away from?
Please do.
So one thing about buying seed for your backyard, bird seed is expensive. It is shocking how much Americans spend on feeding birds in their backyard. But good, clean, quality bird seed is very important. And that then alludes to you should purchase your seed from a good quality place. And straight mixes are often the best because you don't get filler. When you buy a mix, mixes are nice because they create a diversity of food, bringing in a wider variety of birds. But things you want to stay away from are all the fillers that get put in bird seed. Things like grass seed, wheat seed, Milo, red millet. No birds eat that. That is literally waste seed. So those are things you want to stay from. The wheat, the Milo, the grass seed, and red millet. White millet is good. Red millet is not good. And that literally just lays on the ground under your feeders, goes to waste, and creates potential disease and issues. So make sure you find a good, clean mix with sunflower seed, safflower seed, millet, corn, peanuts. Those are the items you want to stick with.
Great.
Yeah, important to check your ingredient list. And of course, we said black sunflower seed, striped sunflower seed, safflower, those top three, plus suet.
Okay. Kathy sent us an email, a listener who wanted to ask you to address the avian flu and the bird flu and feeding birds. I don't know which of you would be better to address this. Which of you would like to answer that?
I'll start. The flu is this thing that we see based on close contact, usually in cultivated birds, in chickens, in chicken farming. And so the problem is this is a virus transmitted by close contact. The birds, the feathers that they have contact with, the feces that the birds drop has the virus in it, and the birds contact it. So it kind of comes and goes. We kill chickens. It kind of wanes again. The problem is that any birds that come in contact with this disease then can spread it. And so when we talk about spread in wild birds, it's usually not a big deal because birds aren't that close together. And so when they're migrating, for example, if they come to a feeder and there is some feces under the feeder, that can be a contaminant. That can be something that contributes to the spread of the disease. But we've talked about this. I mean, we feed because we love birds. We want to bond with birds. That's great. But it's upon you, the onus is upon you to keep that feeder clean. And so it's important to clean up the feeder, keep it sterile, make sure the seed is good, rake up under the feeder, make sure that poop is not there to contaminate things. And so if we do that, we're great. But I want to also remind you, since Jeanette said birds don't really need us, you don't have to feed come April. Birds do great. Start up again in November when it's cold and you reduce the amount of contact with those toxins, the viruses, the salmonella, the mold that comes in your feeders. You reduce all of that. And so that's a great way to do it. Now, if you're really concerned, you can stop feeding for a couple of weeks and hope it goes away. It isn't a great deal of a problem. You can probably feed and not contaminate. It is a personal choice, I think, that you can make to decide what you want to do.
What's the best way to clean those bird feeders and nest boxes then? Jeanette, what's the best tip you can give us for that?
Take some water and a little tiny bit of bleach, scrub them out, and let them air dry. Let them air dry. And realistically, you know, some people say once a week, some people say more often. I know I just read a really nice article by Laura Erickson, who is a birder out of Duluth, and she had a very nice article on her blog about the bird feeding and what she plans on doing this year. And she was talking about putting out less feeders and cleaning them more often with the avian flu going on. So it is important, along with cleaning your feeders, but also underneath it, as Steve mentioned, the droppings. And if you have that wasted seed, that's just, you know, a cesspool waiting to grow. Yes. Of all kinds of things. So cleaning under your feeders regularly is important too. And don't forget the bird baths. If you have bird baths, there's a lot of feces and different things that end up in the bird bath. So clean those out too.
Okay. The number to call, 800-780-9742. You can also email us with questions, ideas@WPR.org. What's the best way to keep squirrels out of those feeders? That's, I feel like that's a constant problem at my house. Steve is laughing.
Forget about it.
Is it a losing battle? Yeah.
You pretty much have to make up your mind that you can fight this battle. There's a guy online, I forget what his name is. He's a very clever scientist, and he does experiments, scientific experiments, to disprove things and show you how science works. Mm-hmm. And I've seen two of his shows online where he's developed what he thought was a perfect squirrel-proof feeder, and they beat it every time. And so I've heard people say, yeah, you can grease the post, you can put some kind of baffle on there, you put it far away so they can't jump onto the feeder. Yeah, sometimes that works. Sometimes I think you just have to make a commitment that you're going to feed squirrels and birds and live with that. And sometimes if you put the feed out in different places, the squirrel might feed on the ground as opposed to climbing up on your feeder. And so there are certain strategies, but you have to kind of adjust your mindset that squirrels are going to be there, and that's not something you can really stop.
Jeanette, what do I do if a local raptor is treating my bird feeder like a buffet?
Ah, you enjoy it and feel lucky that you get to watch such an amazing predator at its best. That's my philosophy.
All right.
I'm also a huge fan of raptors, and I grew up with my dad telling me this is the cycle of life, this is nature, this is what happens. I know not everyone feels that way when the sharp-shinned hawk is eating their cardinal. I think you should embrace nature and feel lucky to witness such a beautiful situation. But if you are concerned about the raptors in your yard, I have to state they are a protected species. So people do sometimes contact me and say, can I shoot it? Can I trap it? No, they are state and federally protected species. You are not allowed to harm raptors. But if you are really concerned or they are being bothersome, take down your feeders. Take down your feeders, give it a couple weeks, the birds will move on. And then you can put your feeders back up. But also to think about, I think it's pretty impressive that there are species of birds like the Cooper's hawks, sharp-shinned hawks, that they truly believe have learned to hunt bird feeders. Now, just think about the intelligence. And people make the comment, oh, bird brain, you know, saying that there's a lack of intelligence. But the intelligence to learn to hunt and watch those feeders, I think, is pretty cool.
It is.
You got to remember,
cool.
too, hawks are at the top of the food chain, and so they're a lot less common than the birds that they feed upon. So the opportunity to see a hawk is rare, pretty uncommon. And you got to think, well, it's at my feeder. I've had this opportunity to see this hawk. That's pretty uncommon. And remember, too, nature will make more cardinals. And that is something that we have to remember. Yes, they're pretty, and you love them, but birds got to eat, and cardinals will come back. They'll bounce back, and all the birds will come back to your feeder in time.
So we talk about the protected species, but there are some bird species that are invasive. They're problems, create some problems for homeowners. A couple of those things, like the starlings, the house sparrows, what can you do about those?
I call these the birds we love to hate, but you got to understand, starlings were introduced around the time of the Civil War. They're now as natural and as American a bird as an American robin. And people don't like starlings because they're super competitors, and they'll sometimes kill their bluebirds, or they'll try to compete with the purple martin nest boxes. And so, yeah, I understand there's a lot of animosity there. But what you can do with them, there are some very specific approaches. If you are a Martin House owner, you can get the right kind of gourd with the right kind of opening. The starling can't get in. We found now that a compressed opening, the Martin can squash themselves to get in, and a starling can't. And so there are some real simple solutions there. When we talk about other things, like keeping house sparrows out of your nest box, the nest size or the nest hole size is imperative. Certain birds won't take a nest if it's too big because they know a super competitor like a starling or a house sparrow can get in there. So a house wren, for example, likes a hole that's about 1 1/8 inch, you know, same with a chickadee. And if you make a bigger hole, they don't like that because the predator can get inside or the competitor can get inside. So the specific things you can do besides hating those birds are pretty straightforward and simple.
Okay. What about woodpeckers? And I want to ask about this specifically because my colleague Joy and I both have this problem where we have woodpeckers that are drumming on our house. And what can you do to prevent that? Jeanette, what are your thoughts?
Shereen, can I ask you, do you happen to have a cedar-sided house?
I do not. I don't know what Joy has. She just let me know. She does not. So I don't know. What's the best way to dissuade that from happening?
Quite commonly when this question is asked of me, the person has a cedar-sided house and woodpeckers love wood. They find insects behind wood. They also want to put their homes in wood. So if you have a wood-sided house, I always say you should expect woodpeckers to pound on it. It is just part of their natural nature. That's what they do. And kind of like Steve's comment about the squirrels, keeping woodpeckers away from your house is difficult. There's lots of things you can do. You can hang streamers. They have these big inflatable eyes. You can put up a replica of a great horned owl. However, those things have to be constantly moved to try to deter to keep reminding the bird that it is a living thing and it's moving around and they should not get used to it. But it is a struggle, and I understand and empathize for people who have real issues with woodpeckers pounding on their house. My parents have it on one side of their house, and every so many years they go and fill up all those holes and wait for the next ones to come. So it is a challenge. Steve, I don't know if you have any other thoughts to add to that.
A lot of times what they're doing is they're broadcasting. They like to drum on noisy surfaces to attract mates, and so I think hanging filament is a really practical idea. To take some really thin filament and hang it over that area, it makes it obnoxious for the bird to bang on that spot. But they are broadcasting, and so you could put up over it maybe a piece of tin just temporarily over that spot so they bang on the tin instead. Or right next to it, hang a piece of tin on a post, and so they'll bang on that instead. And so there are some practical ways you can fight that.
And the woodpeckers are really drumming right now. I know this last weekend I went out in the morning and that was the only thing I heard was downy woodpeckers, hairy woodpeckers, and red-bellied woodpeckers all drumming and calling from different parts in the yard.
Oh, yes. They are very active right now. I can attest to that on Wausau's southeast side neighborhood. Well, Jeanette Kelly and Steve Bechtel are guests today on Route 51 as we continue our discussion on the wild birds of Wisconsin. Coming up, what's behind the Bird City designation that Eau Claire, Wausau, and other Wisconsin communities have, and how people and communities can create a more bird-friendly environment. We'd love to hear from you, too. Join us at 800-780-9742. You can also ask your questions by email at ideas@wpr.org. I'm Shereen Seward. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're back on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward. Our guests today are Steve Bechtel and Jeanette Kelly, professional ornithologists and experts on bird migration. What would you like to know? You can email us at ideas@wpr.org or call us at 800-780-9742 with your bird questions. Steve, you are the liaison for Bird City Eau Claire. What does it take for communities to get that designation? What does it mean? And really, why is it something they do at all?
Bird City is in the vein of other qualifications that we get, other determinations and titles that we get, like Tree City or Playful City. Basically, it's a recognition that birds add to the quality of life, and that if you are looking for a community to live in, then you might find that valuable. That, wow, if there are birds, that means it's a pretty place. It has trees. It's healthy. It doesn't have pollution. And so that's an indicator that we might use to look at a community as attractive. And to get that, you have to follow a kind of a rigorous determination. You have to fulfill some requirements, some prerequisites, like you have to have some kinds of things built into your city plan that are talking about the use of pesticides or a creation of green space or the maintenance of parks, and that things that would encourage healthy bird populations. And it's important because in Wisconsin, birds are in great decline. And so we really do need to look at birds as a part of our community and a contributor to the quality of life in our community. And one of the things that really is clever about Bird City is that they employ this thing called bird-friendly design. And we are just beginning, we're in the infancy of understanding this importance of how birds relate to us. And so we have to look at what kind of toxins do we use, pesticides and herbicides? Do we let our cats out of doors to prey upon wild bird populations? Do we plant for birds, native plants? And do we reduce collision structures? Do we build buildings across our state that are glass and metal? Or do we do what Madison has done and build a policy in place that if you build a building, you know, it's got to be bird friendly? And so Bird City is kind of the originator of this idea, making us think as urban planners about what we do to make things more sustainable and healthy for us and for living things.
That is interesting. I don't know that I've ever thought about bird-friendly design when it comes to buildings. I certainly have thought about bird-friendly backyards when it comes to what to plant. Yeah, right. I mean, what can people do to encourage birds to your backyard? What can you plant? What can you put there?
So there are, this is an important thing as far as looking at native species versus just the beautiful, and I'm not saying native species aren't beautiful, but the beautiful showy things that we might find at the greenhouse. So utilizing native plants are plants that are going to provide natural food sources, natural habitat, natural cover for birds and a multitude of other animals. So bringing in a lot of those natives, there's a whole list. If you go on the UW Extension page, you're going to find a whole list of native plants that you can plant in your yard appropriate for hummingbirds, appropriate for goldfinches. And goldfinches, for instance, I always find this so interesting. They really need thistle. A lot of people don't like thistle. There's a sure. lot of native thistles. And goldfinches are one of our, they are our latest nesting bird in this area because they are waiting for the fluff and the seed from the thistle, which is an August blooming plant. So those native plants create an ecosystem versus the non-native plants, which tend to spread, which tend to take off over, really create a desert biome and provide nothing for the wildlife. And there are a lot of places that you can find native plants. There's Prairie Moon Nursery in the state. Beaver Creek Reserve has a big native plant sale going on right now. Native plants are a really important way to provide a good habitat for wildlife in your yard.
I want to add to that, and I want to say, Jeanette mentioned before that birds need food, water, and cover. I also think they need a fourth thing. They need nesting structure. And that's another thing that you can do with landscaping is plant trees that birds can use to build their nests in. And did you know that the number one and number two unnatural causes of bird mortality are structure collisions? That means bay windows and skyscrapers and wind towers and people allowing their cats to wander out of doors. So I think one of the biggest things that we can do as citizens, as community members, is to keep our cats indoors. Birds are killed by the billions every year by cats let out of door by people. People think that, you know, the cat, it's convenient to allow the cat to range outside, and they don't understand, I don't think, that the pressure upon wild bird populations is immense and catastrophic, and that every time they allow their cat to go out of doors, they're making a choice between the convenience of the cat and the lives of many, many species of wild birds in North America. I have a neighbor, Pete, who has a cat. It's a little male. Its name is Pepper. Pete and I are great neighbors. I love Pepper. We've talked about this, and he keeps his cat leashed in the backyard. He's kind of an urban farmer. He has a huge garden. But that cat, last year, Pete kept a record, and that cat killed 37 rabbits while leashed in the yard. They're incredible predators. They're from Africa. They're an introduced exotic. They don't belong outside. They just wreak havoc on our natural environment.
Wow. We have a dog door, and our cat sometimes escapes out the dog door and goes in, and it freaks me out every time. I try to, like, immediately get him to come back inside for that reason. I want to encourage the birds. I didn't know that about the rabbits. We did have an email from Jerry. He's the mailman in Linden Station, and he said, I noticed that the ground under the feeders is a gathering place for moles. The ground seems to sink quite a bit under the feeders. If I step on it or I drive the lawnmower over it, are moles attracted to the area to eat the grubs or the decaying seeds on the ground? Do you know?
I don't know the answer to that. I would think that there could be some seeds left over that could attract a mole or a gopher, but I'm not sure.
Well, thank you, Jerry, for the email. Appreciate that. And again, ideas at WPR.org or call us at 800-780-9742. Jeanette, I've been meaning to ask you all hour. I want you to tell me a little bit about that banding program. You mentioned it briefly in the early part of the hour at Beaver Creek Reserve. What is the banding program? What does it tell us about Wisconsin's bird population?
Sure. And an important thing I want to say right now before I forget is it's not just telling us about Wisconsin's bird population. It's telling us about bird populations throughout the world, through our country, through other countries. So bird banding is a scientific method utilized to tell us all kinds of information. It can tell us about bird populations. It can tell us about species location. It can tell us about longevity. It can tell us about habitat requirements. It can tell us about migration. It can tell us about disease. It can tell us about pollutants. The list goes on and on about what we can learn about bird banding. And bird banding here at Beaver Creek Reserve has been going on now for over 20 years. We're pushing probably close to 25 years. So this is a long-term banding project now, which I think is really fantastic. And one thing that I think is super cool about our banding program is it was literally started by citizens of the community who were interested in birds. So this wasn't a bunch of wildlife biologists, scientists coming together and saying, hey, let's study the birds. It was interested citizens who said, I want to do this. And so they started bird banding. And we currently at Beaver Creek Reserve, we do a feeder bird banding program at our nature center. So we're looking at the common backyard birds you might be seeing. We do a summer program that is part of a larger international organization where we monitor the breeding populations of birds. So those neotropical migrants that Steve had mentioned, all those beautiful summertime birds we see. We monitor saw-whet owls on their migration route in the fall through banding, and we monitor the nesting success of kestrels through our nest box monitoring program. It has been so interesting. I consider us a relatively small banding program. However, and maybe someone will let me know if it's not the case, but I think we are the only or one of the only year-round banding stations in Wisconsin. I haven't found another one yet that works year-round, but we, as a small station, find out so many interesting things. We had a rose-breasted grosbeak that we banded that was recovered in Nicaragua.
Wow.
So that bird from here, just outside of Eau Claire and Little Fall Creek, made it all the way to Nicaragua. We have had woodpeckers that we have caught year and year again together, side by side, a male and a female. Likely they are a pair. We have trapped birds here at Beaver Creek, and we've also trapped them at other stations that we have. So that same bird we know is moving up and down the Eau Claire River back and forth between these different habitats. For several years, we had the oldest known red-breasted nut hatch in the country. We had captured the oldest known one, and it was something like 6 years and 6 months. And eventually someone caught one that was 6 years and 7 months. So we no longer hold that record, but pretty cool. Even as a small banding station, I mean, there are banding stations out east that capture thousands of birds in a day. We catch maybe 30 birds in a day. So as a small station, we still are doing a lot to contribute to science. And it's a great way to not only contribute to science, but to have public engagement. And I firmly believe if you have public engagement and people learning, that's what's going to really spur them to care and help in conservation.
Steve, I want to ask you to address climate change a bit. I know you're an expert on this, how the climate change impacts wild birds. You addressed this topic recently during a discussion in Minnesota. What do you want people to know about this issue? How climate impacts wild birds?
Yeah, the first thing is I'm calling it climate crisis. There are other people calling it climate emergency. We're well past the indication that there's something changing. So we need to understand that birds, Audubon calls us the greatest threat to birds on the planet. We just talked about how cats and collision structures are number one and two killers. But in the overarching scheme of things, climate crisis will be the thing that affects us most. There's increased aridity. We're seeing changes in seasonal fluctuations. We just talked about how photoperiodism affects bird migration. But a bird that's coming from the Pampas or Uruguay or Paraguay can't tell that the weather is different in Wisconsin and can't adjust their migration. And so there's this thing called mismatch theory. A bird that migrates from the southern part of the Pampas to Wisconsin is coming to get the insect hatch. And what if that insect hatch happens a week early or 2 weeks early? Mm-hmm. And the bird arrives and those insects aren't hatching out in larva form to feed their young as they expect. And so all these little complicated things are happening. I think people should really be aware that it's past the point of saying, you know, is there climate change? Boy, we know it's coming. We don't know how soon and how bad, but there are definitely things we need to do. We need to start talking seriously about, you know, carbon, trading carbon, or making caps, or adjusting the way we live. And that would help our birds, which are extremely threatened and vulnerable. But it would also help human populations. I mean, we know that 60% of the world's population lives within like a mile and a half of the ocean. And the seas are going up at this outrageous rate. If it goes up, 3 feet, the southern half of my Florida is gone. Key West and Miami are gone. If it goes up 5 feet, New Orleans is gone and New York is threatened. So these are very serious things that we need to be discussing and working on as a responsible human population, not just for birds, but for each other.
We know there are many long-term things that we need to address as a society and as a country. But what about some short-term things? Once in a while, we get a freak snowstorm in May or a cold snap. The last time this happened, robins and other migratory birds would just arrive. We're really in trouble. What can we do to help those birds when these kinds of things happen, at least on a short-term basis?
Boy, yeah, that's tough. During those times you talked about that, we had a winter kill last year in Texas that decimated our bluebird population. I think that we're going to see that bluebirds will bounce back because people really care and nurture bluebirds. But the same in that same vein, we had hermit thrushes that were decimated by that storm. And no one's helping hermit thrushes like they are building bluebird boxes. So what we can do in short term is not very much when the weather and the climate are erupting in these disastrous ways. I think we have to make big moves and we have to take big actions to preserve the little ones.
Jeanette, Shereen, if I can
yes,
say
please.
Too, mm-hmm. I think something that I try to stress a lot, and this is where I get a little bit on my soapbox, and this is connecting with what Steve had mentioned. We've got to get out of the mind frame that, oh, that's happening over there. Oh, what's one bird? The fact is, when we look at the connectedness of nature, there is no denying that. Nature is every part of it is truly that web of life that we speak of. There's connectedness everywhere. And like Steve mentioned, the seawater level changing. I mean, all these impacts are not just impacting birds, they're impacting all of us. And so many choices we make every day, and we're all part of it. We're all part of it. There's things I can do better, there's things I choose to do better. But those little things that decisions we make every day, I just read something about if we all stopped using plastic water bottles. Mm-hmm. You know, and why are we putting water in plastic bottles? Talking about that, looking at when we talked about planting native plants. I mean, there's when we put pesticides on our fruit trees and then wonder why there's no bluebirds there to eat the insects. Well, because you killed all the insects and now the bluebirds aren't there. So, I mean, there's just everything we do. We need to think about not only is this an isolated situation where it's harming this one animal, but look at the impact it potentially has on all of us. And like Steve said, short term with weather events, I mean, you know, it's hard to look at situations like that and be like, there's not really anything we can do.
We only have about 15 seconds left. I want to just ask you, Bird School is coming up. Where can people learn more about Bird School?
Yes, go to beavercreekreserve.org and check out our bird school events starting next Thursday through Saturday, a 2.5-day school that Steve and I will both be teaching at. That's a great introduction to birds and birding. Come and join us.
Thank you. You're listening to Route 51. I'm Shereen Seewert, extending a sincere thanks to our guests, Steve Betchkel and Jeanette Kelly. Our producers are Joy Ratch Kramer and Kate Spranger. Our executive producer is Rick Ryer. Rick is also our on-air producer today. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. You can hear the archive of today's program as well as our previous programs at wpr.org/route51. If you have an idea for a future program, email us ideas@wpr.org. Next week, we'll be back with another fascinating discussion, and we hope you'll join us. Until then, we're heading out of town.